Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to CoHealth Checkup, a 30-minute radio show that promises thoughtful debate and lively banter about workplace wellness and employee benefits trends. I'm Fran Melmed, the founder of Context, a communication consulting firm that specializes in workplace wellness, and one of your co-hosts. You can find me on Twitter at F.E. Melmed and online at contextcommunication.com. And I'm joined by my co-host, Carol Harnett.
Hi, Fran, and hi, everyone. I'm Carol Harnett, and I am a health, disability, and employee benefits consultant, speaker, and writer. I'm also the president of the Council for Disability Awareness. You can find me at the Twitter handle, at Carol Harnett, and also at Human Resource Executive, where I write the employee benefits column.
So today we're going to be talking about health risk assessments. These assessments hold a central role in wellness programs for employers, both large and small. The Henry J. Kaiser Family Foundation, which puts out an annual employee health benefits survey, reports that 33% of firms offer employees the opportunity to complete these assessments, which typically identify health behaviors, modifiable risk factors, and medical history, with the intent of informing employers about program design and aiding employees in their health awareness and in changing their health habits. To encourage employees to complete these assessments, employers often offer incentives, from small gift cards to lowered premiums or even HSA contributions, as well as to something more crucial, the ability to enroll in health benefits. Though the percentage of employers tying completion of an assessment to benefits eligibility is small, it does exist, as does the small percentage making the lack of participation in a wellness program or service a penalizable offense when an assessment identifies risks. This shift in employer tactics has caught the attention of the EEOC. In 2014, at least two cases were filed by the EEOC against companies for a violation of the Americans with Disabilities Act, or ADA. Here to discuss with us the purpose and value of health risk assessments is Peter Mills. Peter is co-founder of Engage Health, an organization specifically focused on creating patient engagement and health management solutions for healthcare providers in order to help them address the new challenges brought by healthcare reform. Peter is an established entrepreneur, having grown and sold two businesses in the healthcare sector in the last 15 years. He was a founding team member at the global health management consultancy VLife, which was acquired by Cigna in 2006. And he's also worked extensively with Minneapolis-based Redbrick Health, helping create some of its market-leading health management solutions. Peter trained in medicine at the University of London and is a specialist in respiratory medicine. He still practices on a part-time basis at the Whittington Hospital in London. Peter, welcome to CoHealth Checkup.
Fran, Carol, thank you very much for inviting me.
We're thrilled to have you here, Peter. For our people in the audience, I've had the great pleasure of knowing Dr. Peter Mills for a long time. We first met when he was at VLife, and we were both involved with the Institute for Health and Productivity Management. So really glad to have you here, Peter. And I want to start with helping our audience, because currently, there are a lot of mixed opinions about the value of health risk assessments, particularly in the U.S., where at least large employers can gain access to their employees' summary health and disability data through their insurance companies. And we've even had leaders like Dee Eddington, who I know you've done work with, expressing regret publicly for having spent so much time and energy on HRAs. Can you ground us a little bit in the history of health risk assessments and what the research shows these tools do and don't do for employers and employees?
Yes, and I think the recent publicity or the negative publicity in some ways has overshadowed what I think is a very useful tool in helping both individuals and those responsible for populations of individuals improve their health status. If you look at the history of the health risk assessment or health risk appraisal, and some people use one term, other people use the other, there's some slight semantic differences in what they mean. Typically, a health risk appraisal is collecting data to calculate the likelihood of some sort of disease state or some sort of adverse medical outcome, whereas a health risk assessment is more focused on lifestyle and behavioral aspects of an individual's situation. If you look at the history, people have been using questionnaires to elicit information from individuals for decades. But really, I think the HRA came to the fore in the mid-1990s with the CDC and the Carter Institute, who created their initial HRA to start to capture data from populations and start to utilize that to model future healthcare cost issues and future risks. Carol, you mentioned Dee Eddington. He took that initial work and really took it to the next level, utilizing the HRA that he developed at the University of Michigan in really showing how the data that you collect from an instrument can really help you predict future costs and future risk to an organization. That's the background.
And, you know, do you feel, kind of fast-forwarding to today, how would you explain to an employer why there's sort of a controversy going on now and what these instruments or can do for them and might not do for them?
Yes, I think the controversy is around the initiatives, if you like, that some employers have put in place. So, typically in the 90s, in the the first decade of the 2000s, the employers were encouraging their employees to complete a health risk assessment as part of a broader program, and there was often incentives on the table to do that, and that was great. You know, if you wanted the cash or the reduction on your deductible or whatever the incentive was that was being offered, that was great. You could complete the health assessment, maybe enroll in a program based upon the results and get your incentive. I think now, and especially with the EEOC case, penalizing individuals for not completing a health assessment and removing their healthcare coverage is a step in a slightly more sinister direction, and I know a number of people feel that really this was not the initial objective in offering health management tools to employees. The initial objective was to help really formulate and construct the proactive healthcare initiatives within that population, not to discriminate or not to penalize individuals for having unhealthy behaviors not getting involved, not getting engaged in these sort of initiatives.
Yeah, Peter, it's in my experience, the employers really are relying on these assessments as a behavior change tool. So employers are pushing these out and trying to support them so that an employee has an aha or teachable moment that then is driven to behavior change supported by the resources or the platform that envelops that assessment or that is the follow-on to that.
Yes.
You know, they often cite the individual who completed the health risk assessment, who was prompted to go to the doctor, found something life-threatening. And I myself have a story where my sister-in-law needed to complete an assessment for her employer. As a result of the process, she discovered she had breast cancer. She's had treatment. She's fine. But these are really these one-off stories that people have pinned their beliefs about the assessment as a behavior change tool on. But what does the research show regarding using these as an individual change tool versus that population health value you had spoken of as the when you were going through the history of health risk assessments?
Yeah, I think the traditional stance was that the HRA didn't really have much of an impact upon individual behavior change. It was a data collection tool, if you like, and that was back when, you know, often the feedback that you got at the end of your HRA was not very comprehensive. If it was comprehensive, it wasn't immediate. It would be mailed to you in the post because you completed a paper-based HRA. But with modern technology, with the development of the internet, the World Wide Web, mobile devices, we have a much better opportunity to take the HRA and make it into a behavior change tool, or that first step along behavior change on that behavior change continuum. And that's really based upon, you know, the feedback that we're giving people at the end of completing it. So, you know, with technology, you can really tailor that feedback based upon what initiatives are available to an individual in their location. So if you're an employer, you can, in that HRA feedback, tell people about the quit smoking services that you have available. You can tell them about the subsidized gym. You can tell them about the annual health check that you're entitled to if you're over 50 years old. And actually, I created an HRA for a healthcare provider here in London, where their objective was to try and inform the local population about all of the different initiatives that were available in the community for them. So they did a big drive to push people, anyone who turned up at the hospital, anyone who turned up at any of the clinics, to complete the HRA. They could do it on their mobile device, or they could do it at a kiosk in some of these in some of these clinics. And the objective was to catch people and then to really push them into actionable change. So if you were a smoker, you were given the telephone number of the quit smoking service. If you were overweight, you were given a code as a voucher code for Weight Watchers, so that you could get the first two sessions at half price or something like that. So I think we've got a great opportunity with the mass adoption of technology, and, you know, the majority of the population cutting across all sorts of demographics, socio-demographic groups, the vast majority of the population have some sort of connected device, and we've got a great opportunity to move away from the very static, very research-based and really quite dry HRA to something that's much more engaging, much more visual, a better user experience, but also that provides individuals with actionable information. There's a really interesting study in the JOEM, Journal of the Occupational and Environmental Medicine, at the end of last year on December, which was a three-year assessment of the effects of self-administered HRA on healthcare utilization costs and health risks. And although it's not absolutely coming down in favor of the HRA being a behavior change tool, certainly in the populations that they were looking at, they did see changes in healthcare utilization and healthcare costs in individuals just by virtue of completing an HRA.
That's interesting. I haven't seen that, Peter. I'll have to take a look for that. And I want to expand on some of the things that you were referencing, because I personally have always seen you as an innovator and an experimenter. I mean, you were using Second Life as a way to teach people about health long before most people even knew what Second Life was, never mind that it existed. And so, in fact, I remember us doing a session together on it, and it was fascinating. So there are a lot of different approaches going on right now, and I think it's because of a lot of the tools that you've referenced and using assessments and appraisals as a leaping-off point. Companies like Red Brick Health that you've worked with, Limeade, Rally Health, there's obviously a growing list of them, are using different approaches, such as rewards and challenges and medical experts and social networking and all of those things. how, if you're an employer, again, because I often have great sympathy for these benefits specialists and HR executives, how do they sort through all these things that are going on and make an informed decision about what might be best for their particular group of employees?
That's a good question, Carol, because, you know, I think there is a lot of noise out there. For want of a better word, the digital health landscape is very busy. There's lots of people have a variety of different solutions on offer. And I think it is difficult, or it can be difficult, for employers to cut through this noise and work out what they need, what they want. I mean, in some instances, you know, getting a consultant, getting an independent consultant in to help you really determine, okay, what do you want to achieve in your population? What do you think the key issues are? Because even before doing an HRA within a population, you know, most HR executives have got a pretty good idea about what the health issues are within the population, especially if they're getting reports back from their insurer in terms of, you know, what are the high cost conditions and the utilization within that population. But it can be helpful getting a consultant in, getting an independent consultant in to help you understand what's on offer, and you know, also to fit the budget that is available as well. Many health insurers provide some solutions associated with their insurance products as well. I know certainly when I was at Cigna, we developed a number of digital solutions for Cigna employer clients. And again, I think also it's about asking employees as well what would sit well with them. So I think too often employers will decide on a solution and then present it to their employee base without much buy-in from them. So I think it's really important to actually have that employee input into those decisions.
You know, I couldn't agree
with you
more. Yeah, Fran and I did a show with a group of people around food at the workplace who are all, each in their own right, are innovators. And every single one of them said the same thing, Peter. They said, you have to, if you're going to change a cafeteria or change, you know, what's on the menu or what people is available to vending machines, you should have taste testing with the employees and let them select, and they see a much higher level of participation when they do. And I've yet to see, so do you know of any examples? I've yet to see an employer actually present options to their employee population on this issue of assessment and engagement in health.
I agree with you. Yeah, I, off the top of my head, I can't think of any organization that I've either worked with directly or indirectly who have really put much thought into that. You know, having an internal employee health committee. You know, we do that for so many other different things in our working lives. But I think that's certainly a very proactive step that many employers should take or should certainly consider taking.
Yeah, certainly companies will have wellness committees, but I have also yet to see a company that would offer an evaluation of the available tools and let employees select it. And I think some of that has to do with the fact that one of the things you alluded to, which is they're very expensive tools and they're trying to achieve an awful lot of things. So communicating them into an organization is something that a committee would often have some input on, but not necessarily the total selection process. The other comment I wanted to make, going back to something we were talking about earlier in terms of the way that these tools can act as behavior change tools, really relies on that tailored feedback you were talking about, where the health risk that's identified is connected to a service that the employer offers, whether through the insurer or through that that provider of the platform that delivers the assessment, the insurer, or so forth. And that's really some place where employers struggle. The last time I had seen the number of programs employers offer for wellness, and this is outdated. It was something like 23 or 26, and the struggle is getting these things to connect the dots so that it's fluid and clear to employees. But the question I wanted to ask you next really is about the assailing of these assessments for a number of reasons, including their compliance with GINA and ADA, which we mentioned in the opening of the show. The EEOC filed at least two suits last year, one for Orion Energy Systems and one for Flambeau Inc., over violations in wellness program design related to the use of these assessments and what they consider to be the involuntary requirement that employees complete these. Can you comment upon and advise employers how to stay on the right side of the law? How do they know that what they're doing is in compliance? They're often looking to others to advise them, but what can they know or do or ask to keep themselves clean?
Yes, it is very curious how we've taken, as I said, I think earlier in the show, this slightly sinister turn, away from offering proactive health solutions to our employees to being much more stick and really trying to force them to do things. This really, I think, stems from the fact that healthcare just costs so much money, and employers are desperate to do anything that they can to minimize those costs, or at least prevent the inexorable rise in those costs. The GINA Act was an interesting one. It made a lot of HRA companies remove questions about family history or anything that could be construed as being out of an individual's control in terms of their genetic makeup. At the time, I remember very clearly I was working at Red Brick, and we had to pull out some family history questions, and you kind of thought it was a little bit extreme. But I can understand, to a certain extent, where the legislators are coming from in that respect. Ultimately, you can't do anything about your family history. It's useful for your physician to know about your family history if they're going to be treating you on a one-to-one basis, but it's probably not that useful for your employer. Ultimately, people need to be free to refuse to do something that is not core to their role and responsibility within the organization. I believe that we have to have freedom of speech and thought, but also freedom of action within the law. So I think fine, give people incentives, make those incentives really compelling, but ultimately at the end of the day, if individuals do not want to complete a health assessment or get involved in a health promotion or health management program, then I don't think under the law there's really anything that we can legitimately do as employers.
Yeah, it's interesting, Peter. When we had Dean on the show after the Penn State professor, you may recall, about 18 months ago now, had pretty much started an internet ruckus with coming back to campus and finding that not only did they have to complete an HRA, they had to do a physical exam as well. And Dee's main point was, he said, look, HRAs were designed to be voluntary. And he said, when you change the voluntary nature, he said, in many ways you violate the design. And we all know that people start making things up sometimes, which was this professor's passive-aggressive way of dealing with it. He coached people on how to lie and yet still comply with the simple requirement that you had to take the HRA. So I think that's a point that employers would be well-served to not lose, because when the researcher's saying it should be voluntary, when you're saying it should be voluntary, I think that's an important thing for us to keep in mind. And speaking of critics, go ahead, sorry, please.
Absolutely, yeah, because ultimately you're right, Carol, because if you're going to force people, if there's going to be, much more stick than carrot, then people will lie. And that makes everything else that comes out of the back of the HRA. It makes the analysis of the data, the recommendations that the provider of the employee health management solutions, makes everything that stems from there doubtful, because you don't know whether you've got real data and real facts that you're working with.
Right, bad data in, bad data out is what I remember from doing research. So we continue to have critics in the wellness space, which has obviously been a topic for another show. But when those critics have looked at the value, again, of assessments, one of the things that they levy against them is that they lack a contemporary focus. And some of the examples that are given is that many of the assessments have a continued focus on seatbelt use as a current public health concern, when texting while driving may be a much more significant and current way to look at the issue of driving safely. There's also been debate among these groups on how individuals are put into risk pools based on the number of risks versus the type or the quality of the risks. And a question that comes up, but I actually haven't seen discussed, is how frequently do vendors update the risk algorithms they use in their HRAs, and how diverse are the populations that are included in those algorithms?
I think all good questions. I agree with you with the seatbelt risk. That may have been relevant 20 years ago, but the majority of people I know anyway wear their seatbelt now, so it's not a differentiator. So we need to find a different differentiator. It was interesting. I was working with an organization in Australia a few years ago now, about 10 years ago now, and we initially had a health risk assessment with them. They were an insurance company there, and it had the seatbelt question in. And they looked at us and said, why have you got a seatbelt question? And everyone wears a seatbelt. We were saying, well, it's kind of a proxy for risk. If you don't wear a seatbelt, you're kind of a risk taker. And they were saying, well, actually, in our society, the best proxy for risk is, do you put suntan lotion on before you go outside? And that makes it really relevant for different societies, different communities. Because yes, I agree with you. There are certain things that are relevant in Western societies, which are just not relevant in other communities and in other groups. So, as well as modifying the algorithms within a health assessment based upon the data that you've got, based upon ongoing research that you should be doing with the data, looking at the correlation between healthcare costs, healthcare utilization, workplace productivity, performance, all the different aspects that we know health risks have a relationship with, but that can vary over time. So completely agree. We should be, and the best companies are, examining their algorithms and the questions that they ask on a regular basis, at least every sort of 2 to 3 years. So as well as that, we do need to make sure that they are culturally localized, if you like, for different populations. One size does not fit all.
Mm-hmm. Well said.
Well, I know that we are coming up on the I don't know if you call it the top or the bottom of our show, but I want to switch us to a question that we ask all of our guests. We believe very much in the power of learning from things that don't quite work out like we envisioned them, and so we would like to close with asking you to talk to us about one thing or one time when you had a great idea and it didn't quite work out like you envisioned.
Yeah, and actually Carol alluded to it a little bit earlier on. So back
tipped you off, huh?
Yeah, back in about 2009, I got really interested in three-dimensional virtual worlds. A lot of the researchers out there, the Gartners and people like that were really bigging up the technology behind them, and predicting that by about 2015, you know, 80% of the population would have an avatar and would be actively involved in virtual world communities and the like. And I found this fascinating. I love technology, so you know, it was natural that I really liked this. Put together a project with a couple of friends of myself to create a health coaching environment in Second Life. Second Life was the biggest of the virtual worlds then. Everything pointed towards this being something that should be adopted, that people would want to adopt and get involved in. But as it turns out, no one really wanted to do that. There were still, and it's still the truth today, people are still quite happy with their two-dimensional computer screen and the information that gets delivered to them through that, and there really wasn't that much of an interest in engaging in these 3D worlds. So that was something that should have worked. I still look back on it and think, well, why didn't it work? But you know, we were ahead or we were tangential to the way that actually the majority of people were thinking at the time.
I would have to say you were ahead. Having attended and presented at the Games for Health conference and seen some of the work that they've done with this type of environment, immersive environment for everything from teenage sexuality and positive and healthy sexual behavior to drug addiction and substance abuse to even PTSD, I think you were just ahead of your time. So maybe if you want to dabble back in, now the time is ripe.
Well, I will tell you, because of Peter, I did have an avatar, and she was very nice looking on Third Sexual. It was very fun. I tried for a while, and it was a really interesting experience. But I think much like the three of us, we actually all enjoy technology and playing with it. And sometimes I have to remind myself that I am not the norm. And so maybe what I like, no one else does. So.
Well, I want to thank you, Peter. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Carol.
No, go ahead. Go ahead, friend. Wrap it up, girl.
I just, Peter, I wanted to thank you very much for sharing your expertise and experience with us, and thank our listeners who are always touching base with what we're talking about and giving us ideas about what we should talk about next. Our next show will air on Wednesday, April 1st, not April Fool's joke, at 12 noon. And you can listen to that show as well as today's show and all others on demand at any time at Blog Talk Radio, iTunes, and Stitcher. Carol and Peter, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Fran. Thank you, Peter.